It seems to be very obvious that Mr. Deaver is going to tiptoe around the matters that are embarrassing to the position that he's trying to defend. The only alternative left to me is to follow him where he goes. I will have two nights to defend my proposition. That should be ample time for me to put some of these issues before you. He began his his second affirmative speech with rebuttal arguments, and he referred to the copy of the Koran that I had on the table that I mentioned to you. And he had the temerity to say that he is not a member of the Lord's Church. For the benefit of those in the audience who may not understand what he means by this, let me explain that he means that the Church of Christ is it. It is the only church. If you're a Baptist, if you're a Methodist, if you're a Presbyterian, you're in the wrong group. And that's just too bad for you. You're not going to make it. When the judgment roll is called, you're going to be on the left side like I am tonight in the debate. But anyway, he said he is not a member of the Lord's Church because he was born in this country. Yet it's interesting to know that he is over at the table sitting with his father, who just happens to be a preacher of the Church of Christ. Now, isn't that a coincidence? Every time I talk to these people about this, and try to get them to think critically and understand the principle that I was trying to get you to think about, I referred to the Koran only because I want you to understand that there are people in the world who view their sacred books in the same way that you view yours. You say that they're wrong, that they're dead wrong, they couldn't possibly be right. And I just wanted to give you something to think about. But anyway, it's interesting that whenever I talk to these people, they vow and declare that they are not members of the Church of Christ because they were born into a particular family, but they have just happened to critically examine all of the doctrines and precepts that are taught by this church, and lo and behold, by sheer coincidence, it just happens that this is the Bible, this is the church that's described in the Bible. I reject his premise. I'm quite certain that his father, in other words, his family background, had a great deal to do with what church he is a member of. He said that he was not embarrassed by the Amalekite slaughter. Well, I'm going to be honest with you people. I don't know how to deal with a man like that. Here's a situation where God, presumably, commanded Saul to get his army together and go over and utterly destroy the Amalekite nation for something really that was done 400 or 450 years before that time, not for something that they themselves had done, but for something their ancestors had done. Go over and utterly wipe them out, male and female, infant, suckling. Not only that, to destroy all of their livestock too. Just wipe them off the face of the earth. Now, he says he's not embarrassed by that. Well, I'm going to suggest that that's his problem. That's not my problem. He said that from the position that I have no right to criticize God on moral grounds. In other words, he's saying that I don't have the right to use my brain, to use my intelligence. He says, I have no right to read a story like that in the Bible and decide that if that actually happened, that was a terrible thing. for Saul to do. I don't care how many times his God told him to do it or how many times he thought his God was telling him to do it. If I have no right to criticize God on moral ground, then I have no right to use my intelligence. I ask you to imagine me beating the gentleman that he's identified as Kevin over the head with a chair. So I'm going to ask you to imagine something else. Let's imagine a jungle savage who's never heard of the Bible, has no idea that the Bible even exists, and he sees a member of his tribe doing something that just doesn't seem to be right to him. Does he have a right to make that kind of judgment? Does he have a right to use his intelligence and decide on the basis of empirical experience that it's just not a good thing for him to do that? I thought that because I've not had time to get to everything that he said, that I therefore had no time to get to the list of questions that I presented to him, and I certainly wanted to. But if I understood him correctly, he said that even though this is my last speech tonight, that he wouldn't object if I referred to those questions. And so I'm going to do that. Question number one was this. If John Jones believed that God exists and that Jesus Christ was his son, and if Jones honored his father and mother, practiced the golden rule, loved his neighbor as himself, did good to those who despitefully used him, visited the fatherless and widows in their affliction, always turned the other cheek and walked the second mile, always spoke only the truth, never killed, never stole, never committed adultery, obeyed the laws of the land, and did everything else the Bible indicates as morally good, but refused to be baptized because of a sincere belief that baptism wasn't necessary for his salvation, would he be a bad man solely because of his refusal to be baptized? His answer, yes. Romans 3:23, that scripture says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. For those of you in the audience who may not understand, it is a doctrine of the Church of Christ that unless you're baptized, dipped in water, immersed, that you cannot have your sins forgiven. By saying yes in answer to this question, you know what he's saying? He is saying that an act is good solely on the basis of whether God says to do it or not. An act can become good if God says to do it. No wonder he believes that it was a perfectly good thing for Saul to utterly wipe out an entire nation of people because God told him to do it, and so that made it good. But I've asked you people, and I've said that I'm going to defend my proposition on this premise, that I'm going to ask you to think sensibly, and I'm going to ask you to use your intelligence and try to decide on that basis whether a thing is moral or not. When you see a friend or relative or neighbor do something that you consider to be a good thing, if you can use your intelligence to make that judgment, and that if you see a friend or neighbor or your government do things that are so horrible and atrocious, they shock your sense of decency, why in the world then would you defend the God of the Bible if he did things that were just as bad as that, if not worse? So I want you to understand that Mr. Deaver is saying that a thing can become good solely because God says to do it. That has to be what he's saying, because there just can't be anything inherently good about being dipped in water. And yet Jones, in my example, is a bad man if he does every single good deed that the Bible tells him to do, but out of an honest, sincere belief, he doesn't think that he needs to be baptized. That's a bad man, in Mr. Deaver's opinion. My second question was this. If objective morality exists, would God, if he too exists, be subject to the standards of that morality? In other words, if it's improper for the Iraqis to kill the Kuwaitis in mass numbers, would it be okay for God to kill the Amalekites in mass numbers? He understood why I was asking that. That's why I answered the question like this. God is, with the word is underlined, God is that objective standard. He is not subject to himself. Well, now, wait a minute. God is that objective standard. Is a linking verb. The predicate nominative, and we're getting into my field now, I'm a college English teacher. Objective standard is a predicate nominative, linked back to the subject God, but the linking verb is. They're the same thing. They can therefore be switched around, and the sentence would be, the objective standard is God.
Is he going to take the position that the objective standard is God?
Almost thou persuadest me to be a believer in God, if that's the position that you're going to take, because you're not far from what I would believe myself, if that's the position that you're going to take. Which existed first, God or objective morality? His answer, since God is objective morality is God, you see. They exist simultaneously. That's, of course, the position that he would have to take, and I knew that he was going to take it. I wanted to get him on record for that, and you'll find out why later on. If God existed before objective morality existed, did God use intelligence to determine what is moral and what is immoral? Well, on the basis of the way that he answered the question before that, it really isn't necessary to read his answer to that question. My last question was this. If morality can be so determined, that is, if morality can be determined by intelligence, could man, without any revelation or assistance from God, use his intelligence to determine what is moral and what is immoral? His answer was, by natural revelation, man can know, in parentheses, have insight into the distinction between morality and immorality. But such an insight is possible only if man is in God's image. I wonder if that's the gospel according to Deaver. I wouldn't claim to know everything that's said in the Bible, although I've read the book through many times. I don't know anywhere in the Bible that such a statement as that is made. Such an insight is possible only if man is in God's image. And without God, there could be no objective obligation to that insight. Well, first of all, I'm not taking the position that objective morality exists. And I want to emphasize that to you over and over again. He's not going to have to stand here and tell you that, because I'll tell you that myself. I do not believe that there is any such thing as objective morality, but that is very different from saying that there is no such thing as morality. I think the example that I used in banging Kevin over the head with a chair was a good one. I was simply trying to illustrate that from experience we can learn that if things are harmful to others, that they're not good to do. And that we can learn from that that it is in our best interest not to do things that are harmful to others, because eventually, unless we practice that code of conduct, we might find ourselves victimized in the same way. Now, I'm going to ask you people to think seriously about this. Are you moral people because God has told you not to do X, Y, and Z, and you're afraid that you're going to go to hell if you do these things? Or are you good moral people simply because your intelligence tells you that it is in your best interest and in the best interest of the society that you live in to be a good person?
I could take this book where it says not to kill, and I could tear that page out and throw it away, and every other scripture that says not to kill, or if this book had never even existed, I still would not kill. I don't need a revelation from God, a so-called revelation from God, to tell me not to kill.
And I wonder about people who, in effect, take the position that they don't do these things because God has told them not to do these things. And you wonder if they would want to do them if God had not given restrictions on them. You women in the audience who are married, do you want your husband to be faithful to you because he's afraid that he'll go to hell if he isn't? Or would you rather have him be faithful to you because he loves you and he respects you and he understands that if he's not faithful to you, that would hurt you emotionally? Which would you rather have? In my book, there's no contest. But he's here to tell us that unless God comes down on Mount Sinai, or unless he guides the hand of the Apostle Paul or Peter or whoever's written an allegedly inspired book and says, don't do X or do Y, that it's impossible for us to know. Because there can be no objective standard without God. Okay, there can be no objective standard without God. We're not going to debate that. But that's not the same as saying there can be no standard of morality without God. You know, he can talk all that he wants to about subjective morality, situational morality, whatever he wants to call it. But he believes in situational morality. I know he does. Let me use an example. He introduced me to, I don't know whether he has a daughter or not, but let's just suppose that he has a daughter about the age of his sons. And where he lives in Austin, the neighborhood has been terrorized by a rapist. And one night while his daughter is sleeping upstairs, he's downstairs reading the Bible, and all of a sudden he looks up. He sees a man in a mask holding a gun on him, and the man says, where is your daughter? Does he say, oh, I cannot lie, she's upstairs, second door to the left. Now, if morality is absolute, and he's afraid that he's going to spend eternity in hell if he tells a lie, in the denotative sense of the word lie, then he'd have to do something like that. He finds a penny on the sidewalk. Does he pick it up and say, oh, I've got to run down to the police station and turn this in so that it can be returned to its owner? Or does he simply put the thing in his pocket? But what if he found a $10 bill? What if he found a $100 bill? What if he found a paper clip that had $1,200 bills on it? Would he say, finders keepers, losers weepers? or would he report the finding to the police? I'm sure that he would report it to the police. So it's simply a matter of how much is found. But if morality is absolute, if there is such a thing as this objective morality that he's talking about when he finds a penny, he needs to run down and report it to the police, or he's in dire danger of losing his soul. He asked, he said that the Gentiles didn't have a revelation as the Jews had done, but that it is true that they still did by nature the things of the law. Well, you know, I wonder, why did the Jews need the revelation? If the Gentiles could just figure it all out on their own, why couldn't the Jews figure it out on their own? If I misrepresented him in about in what I said about feeling the conscience, then I'm sorry. I honestly didn't hear him say that I haven't touched my conscience. But I believe that basically that what I said is still the truth. I can feel my conscience. Certainly I wasn't trying to tell you that my conscience is something tangible like this book that I can reach out and feel. Yet I know that I have one through empirical experience. I know that I have a concept of beauty. Yet that concept is not something that I can lay out on the table and touch like I can touch this book. But I can look at a painting and say, that's a beautiful painting, or I can see a woman and say, that's a beautiful woman. And how in the world could I do that unless I had a prior concept of beauty? And in the same way that I can know that I have a concept of beauty, a concept of ugliness, because I have certain feelings, emotional feelings, that tell me these things, and I can know that I have a conscience. Because when I do things that I see are destructive to the people that I come in contact with, quite frankly, that bothers me, and to me, that's very definitely related to feeling.
He said that God has the right to terminate an Amalekite. He makes it sound like a Pentagon euphemism where they call a weapon of mass destruction an anti-personnel device. But God didn't just terminate an Amalekite. According to the story, he terminated the entire nation of Amalekites.
Except for Agag, their king, and he was displeased because that one person had been spared, and he sent Samuel the prophet to meet Saul on the way by and had Samuel hack Agag to pieces with a sword. So it wasn't just an Amalekite that he terminated. He terminated an entire nation of Amalekites. And I'm going to tell you, if he can't see something wrong with that, that's his problem, not my problem. I wonder where his intelligence is.
If he can't see that what the Iraqis did when they were in Kuwait is different from the Amalekite atrocities that Saul committed, if he can't see that those things were not as bad as what Saul did, presumably under the instructions of God, then, as I said, he's the one who has the problem.
He asked how I could know that God was guilty of immorality when I wasn't there. Certainly I wasn't there, and I'm not saying that I know from my own personal experience that this event happened. I do know this. I do know that it's recorded in the Bible. I know that. He's the one who's saying that if it's recorded in the Bible, then it happened in exactly the way that the Bible stated it. And I'm not going to let him off the hook on this one. Before the debate is over, he's going to have to deal with this issue. I see that my time is up. He has a 5-minute rejoinder. Please give him your careful attention.
Kevin, if you will, put my chart on my questions for Mr. Till up there. I don't want us to lose sight of the way that he has proceeded. He has answered these questions in such a way that regardless of what he says from then on regarding God's being guilty of something, it makes no sense. And I'm going to keep pressing that. I don't know what else to do. He said he doesn't know how to deal with a man that's not embarrassed about the way God treated the Amalekites. I don't know exactly how to respond except to keep on saying you're already caught in a bind, a logical bind. You're caught in self-contradiction. And I hope that by stressing these things, eventually, that he will see this. He's reduced ethics to physics, and number one, so there is no ethical value that's of a spiritual quality at all. Bad means it's just unfortunate mud. That's all it means. A person's knowledge is limited to what comes from his senses. He still wants to think he's got a conscience, but he knows he has never had physical relationship with his conscience. Now, he's not going to get up here and say, I don't have one. But he knows he has not experienced it physically. He said, well, I felt it or whatever. He has not felt it physically. The conscience is not a physical organ anyway, any more than his mind is. It's an aspect of human mind, that's true, but mind is not brain. Not going to let him fall into that. If he were a behaviorist psychologist or something of that sort, he would be treating people on the basis that they're just glorified apes. Your mind is not your brain. Now, your mind utilizes brain. Your mind intelligence is not reducible just to chemistry, molecular sequence. If that's all there is no objective right and wrong on this earth, ever, under any condition. Three, I know that I have a conscience. He doesn't, given the way he approaches knowledge. Now, I'm going to grant him the benefit of the doubt. He knows it, but he knows it another way. But he can't know it given his restricted epistemology in number one. He's caught again. Four, an absolute objective moral standard exists. And did you hear him a while ago? These concessions are marvelous. There is no objective morality without God. He admitted it. He said it. But he says that's not the same thing as saying there's not a morality or whatever. He's saying that I can still detect various gradations of proper conduct somehow without an objective standard. If you do not have an objective standard, you cannot tell who is closer and who is farther away from it. How in the world can you detect that that's a better man than that one if there's not an absolute good? You can't. And he's already given up by saying, without God, I admit it. There is no objective morality. Really, that's conceding the whole discussion. And you can't cling to some sort of gradations in ethical conduct anyway, recognizing the superiority and the inferiority of this one, when there is no way you can objectively gauge them. It reduces itself to what Farrell, Till, and other persons like. I don't like it when somebody hurts me, so don't do that. Or you can do it, a social approbation like David Hume do. It's not good for the country. We'll have the country decide what's in its best interest. That's going to be morality. Countries don't agree on their own best interest. Individuals in the country don't always do that, and certainly we've had national clashes over it. Whose theory of best interest are you going to take? Mr. Till. You've already X'd God out. There's no objective standard. Is it going to be Iran's regard for her own best interest? Iraq's? Africa? America? Russia? Whose is it going to be? He has no right to criticize. His discussion of the morality, saying that I really believe in situational ethics, is just a joke. That's just false. And that illustration about my family is not really to the point. Regardless of what I would do, I can tell you what I should do. I can give you some ethical options open to me. Whether I'm man enough to do the right thing is another question, and maybe I'm not. I hope I would do, but I'm not going to say I'd do the right thing. But saying what I would do and saying what I ought to do, there could be a distinction, and I'll grant it. But I'll tell you what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that I've gone into situationism because I refuse to tell the intruder where my daughter is. I'm under no moral obligation at all to give him an answer. Thank you.